Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management. We've made it back with our 50th episode of Not Artificially Sweetened, the podcast for all things diabetes. As usual, Stan Landau with me in studio.
Great news, Michael. Hello, everybody.
And as promised back in episode 42, we are again joined by the glucose glitch, Lorena Faree, type 1 diabetes advocate, poet, content creator, and professional photographer living with type 1 diabetes. And she joins us again to involve you, our listeners, by helping us to answer your pressing questions on anything related to diabetes. Welcome, Lorena.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks, Stan.
Listeners, thanks again for joining us on this podcast. Remember, you can find us on your favorite social media channels such as Spotify, Pocket Casts, the Apple Podcasts, and the Listen mobile audio app. Should you have any comments, thoughts, or questions you want to share with us, and perhaps the wider audience listening out there, don't hesitate to drop us a line at podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. This week's podcast, again, is brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and the CDE MyWell Reduced Calorie Product Range. As we heard on last week's episode, a once-off visit to the dietitian simply isn't enough to see lasting results. Research shows that therapeutic dietary programs supported by a registered dietitian result in better outcomes, especially when targeting the loss of excess body fat and in weight maintenance. CDE MyWell products are designed to be used as part of a medically supervised very low-calorie diet or a VLCD program. This nutrition intervention is backed by sound research showing that a structured VLCD program really works. So check out the CDE MyWell range in the CDE online pharmacy at cdeonline.co.za/MyWell.
Thanks very much, Stan, for that introduction. Well, I'm looking forward to this episode. It's my happy space answering questions, but I want to start with the lovely experience I had last Friday. We went to the stage show Queen, It's a Kind of Magic. Within 10 minutes, I was sold. The lead for the performance, Warren Vernon Driscoll, blew my socks off. And as someone who's played guitar at church for the last 45 years, I know a fair bit about music, not a lot, but I know enough to know a musical master when I see one. And that was certainly my impression after the first 10 minutes. What was then next amazing for me after that first 10 or so minutes, when I was already sold on the performance, Warren took off his jacket and I saw on the back of his arm a CGM or continuous glucose monitoring patch. And from there, for the rest of the show, I was transfixed as I saw this young man, South African performer, take that show, take the audience on a ride of our lives. We have spoken about people with diabetes in very responsible positions before, like commercial airline pilots. Jonathan showed us that people with diabetes can handle that responsibility. And I just thought about the responsibility of single-handedly carrying the responsibility for a show of that magnitude. Of course, there were lots of other performers, but if Freddie Mercury goes down, well, that's the end of the party. So I just wanted to bring attention to that amazing show. And it's going to finish on the 14th of this month in its Johannesburg run. And then I think they're off to Ontario and Canada. If you can catch that show wherever you are in the world, you need to catch it because it is well worth it. And it's such an example of advocacy for the rights and the abilities of people with diabetes in action. And Warren, you were and you are amazing. And we hope we can get you on the show, but that's another story for another day, hopefully.
It'll be great to have somebody of that caliber on the show. Wonderful Queen music, you know, who doesn't love Queen? And you think of Bohemian Rhapsody and those multitude of genres woven into this kind of performance. And I always take the metaphor a bit far, like diabetes, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that comes together in an absolutely powerful component. Nice feedback there, Michael. It's been a busy clinic week as well. We've come in from all these public holidays at the moment, and as we always remind our listeners, the seasons are turning. Don't forget to have that flu jab between now and the first week of June. Something we see quite a lot of in clinical practice are issues around bladder continence, both men and in women.
Right.
And certainly something that we've become a little bit more comfortable discussing. In fact, many of the topics around diabetes we've become more comfortable. We've spoken about female sexual health matters, continence issues, erectile dysfunction, and very often continence issues aren't brought up because they don't really impair the longevity of the person, but they are profoundly intrusive from a quality of life point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things just for the listeners to think about. First of all, not all continence issues are necessarily diabetes related. You can have a difficult childbirth, for example, and you can have a bladder prolapse. You can have a uterus prolapse, and they can also affect continence. Chronic constipation itself is also associated with incontinence. In fact, it's a very often overlooked condition.
Mm.
One of the more common causes of continence issues of urine is a condition called overactive bladder. Now, this is a bladder that's itchy and irritable, and you pass small amounts of urine all the time. One of the questions I always ask people when we're talking on this topic is, where do they park when they go shopping? Because people with continence issues undertake what we call toilet mapping. That's to have in your mind's eye, where in the shopping center are the toilets? Where should we park at which entrance? Just in case we need to go quickly and find our way. And it's amazing when you start asking people about those habits to empty their bladder, or perhaps to keep their bladder not emptying on its own. It's a really big deal, and it gets to the heart of what's really important for the person in front of you over and above just spending the visit slavishly thinking about blood glucose. So important to talk about, important for listeners there with diabetes, or if you look after somebody with diabetes, bring it up.
Mm.
It's easily treatable in the modern day. We've got some great medicines. Physiotherapy can certainly play a role, and in less common cases, Botox even, and some surgical procedures. So I want to highlight that it's not just confined to the older person. It's a common condition amongst people with diabetes.
Absolutely. And I'd like to take that further to say a lot of people with incontinence tend to reduce their fluid intake. And that's the worst thing, because then you are prone to things like urinary tract infections. So as you've said, please bring it up. Your doctor's not going to be embarrassed. Your nurse educator is not going to be embarrassed. We are here to help. And as you said, there are treatments available.
Michael, your issue on thirst and water consumption brings up another point, that a lot of the treatments that are used to treat continence issues themselves may result in dry mouth.
Mm-hmm.
A popular product in South Africa called VisiCare, perhaps one of its generic versions, and almost everybody who's going to be on those tablets going to have a dry mouth. And often it's inappropriately blamed on markedly elevated blood glucose levels, which isn't the case. And it's just the mechanism of how these drugs work.
Right.
To relax the bladder, they also relax, in inverted commas, the amount of saliva that the gland secretes. So It all links up in due course.
Right. So, Lorena,
yes.
It's over to you.
Sure.
You are our facilitator to connect us to the community that we are here to serve. And again, I want to reiterate, Stan and I have no prior knowledge or sight of the questions you're going to ask. This is live, on the fly, and it's our happy space. So what have you got in store?
Wonderful. That's correct. We've got a wide variety of questions. So I'm going to start with a question from a mom called Bianca.
I'm a mother living with a daughter. She's 7 years old, and she's been type 1 diabetic now for almost 4 years. And I would like to find out, how does diabetes affect our children's ability to concentrate? And what can we use to enhance their concentration, seeing that my little one is in grade 1 this year?
Wow, there's a lot there. Let me start off by saying this. Having type 1 diabetes in early childhood doesn't automatically imply that concentration is going to be poor, or performance perhaps in the school class is necessarily not going to be good.
Mm.
So it's always important to think that many of the behaviors that come out in early primary school, such as the commonly seen attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactive disorder, may or may not directly be linked to diabetes, but it's important that that assessment be thoroughly appraised. Because in order to understand the impact of the blood glucose directly to the heart of this question, you could almost think of it in direct and in indirect manners.
Mm.
Because people with diabetes carry a lot of gear with them and are monitoring and are testing, and if they have access to a cell phone in the classroom, and they're eating to raise their blood sugar, or they're drinking water to bring their thirst down as a result of a high blood sugar level, or their bladder is full and they're leaving class to go and empty their bladder, they're up and down all the time as a direct consequence of the fluctuations in blood glucose levels, as well as the alarms and beeps and vibrations that may come about from a continuous blood glucose monitoring device. So it's easy to understand how a young person, or perhaps anybody with diabetes, would easily be distracted as a result of needing to deal with what could potentially become a life-threatening rise or reduction in blood glucose levels. Michael, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this because long before I got involved in diabetes, you were treating both adults and kids because in those early days, there just weren't a lot of people involved in diabetes medicine. So I definitely want to hear what your thoughts are on this.
I'd concur with you, Stan. The distracting events around diabetes self-management are possibly a factor. And as you said, it needs to be assessed. However, I think it has become one of those common, let's say, diagnoses that may be often overdiagnosed. And of course, should you have attention deficit or hyperactivity disorders, they do need to be diagnosed and treated. But at the same time, they should not be inappropriately diagnosed. Because kids at that age are not actually designed to concentrate. They are designed to explore their environments. So I just urge that as a bit of caution, just not to rush into diagnoses that may not be necessarily appropriate.
I want to add this, that if the young person is privileged to have access to continuous blood glucose monitoring, it's easy at that point in time to recognize if there is indeed fluctuation in blood glucose in play at the time of the poor concentration. If you're reliant on finger prick testing, it's a lot more difficult. But I don't think we can make a blanket idea that all fluctuations in blood glucose levels automatically are associated with lack of concentration, particularly in the classroom setting. Mm. When you chat to a healthcare professional, we want to know if this is outside the classroom as well. We want to know what happens in social environments. What happens when the child's at home? What happens when they're at friends? What happens overnight? So it's nice because the classroom is a very focused, dedicated couple of hours of a day. And as Michael said, the kid has to be concentrating at that point. But if this is somebody who's able to sit at home and do their homework and can watch television and play comfortably with their friends, then that's telling me a different story.
Yes.
And perhaps there is a behavioral issue, perhaps within the school that needs to be attended to. But if that behavior were well outside of the school, at friends, at family, at the grandparents, aha, then perhaps something more akin to fluctuations in blood sugar is certainly going on. So a very good question. Lorena, if you allow me, I just want to go further. And many moms and dads who have kids with underlying ADD or ADHD will know that medications like Ritalin and Concerta and those more modern medications to manage the behavioral and scholastic aspects are often associated with appetite suppression.
Mm.
And that's a big deal because you give your young people these pills before they head off to school. They've had their breakfast and then their pill. And they don't want to eat for the rest of the day.
Right.
And man, that can be pretty frustrating and difficult to manage diabetes because you have this expectation. They're going to eat, they're going to play. So that needs careful discussion with the diabetes team, especially if there are medications such as Ritalin.
Right. And that can result in risks for hypoglycemia in the short term. And in the long term, you might see a fall off in their growth rates on their growth charts. Final thing I want to say about this is that kids with diabetes, I've seen, often are not afforded the same attention to routine and discipline that other kids are. And just because a child has diabetes, we shouldn't be relaxing and saying, oh, shame. And that's not to say we don't have empathy with their position and their extra burden of self-management. But in fact, kids with diabetes thrive more in an environment where there is structure and there is routine, and that may help the so-called symptoms of not paying attention.
If I may add something, I've realized that at times when I concentrate extremely hard working on certain projects, I have more lows than I'd expect myself to have because I'm not physically active. I'm sitting behind my computer, but my brain power is going through the roof. And then I experience 2 to 3 lows within a few hours where I would usually just not experience that. I think it's directly related to this question as well, but just from the angle.
Yeah, point well made.
The brain is actually one of the largest consumers of blood glucose. So quite plausible. Right, what's next up on the menu?
Okay, we have another mom question. I call them mom questions, but the parents are quite inquisitive and they bring quite a few interesting questions to the table. So I really want to incorporate them as well. We have a mom, Rulene.
Good afternoon, Lorena. It's Rulene here. I'd like to know, my daughter, she is a type 1 diabetic and she is 8 years old. I would like to know what the long-term effects is of drinking sugar-free cool drinks, specifically like Coke Zero. Thank you so much. Bye.
Okay, so I think brand names aside, it's pretty uniform. So a statement came out from, I think it was the World Health Organization late last year that did an analysis of artificial sweeteners. And they came back with actually quite a scathing criticism of those additives to foods, but on a very low evidence base. There are many, let's say, myths out there about all the problems that artificial sweeteners can cause. They're largely unfounded. There's actually not too much evidence for their use. However, having said all that, I think that if someone's drinking 3, 4, 5, 6 artificially sweetened drinks per day, there is a problem. It's a problem in maybe how they need to get a sense of fulfillment. The other thing is that cold drinks usually contain phosphates. And Stan, I don't know if you can say any more on that, but they are implicated, and this is to me the more important issue, in young kids and in young girls especially. We know that girls, women, they can battle as they get older with reduced bone mass. And so what phosphates tend to do is they tend to reduce bone mass. Stan?
Yeah, spot on in that sense. I think, Lorena, we come to the equation here that there's nothing more healthy than water.
Yeah.
The registered dietitians will tell you exactly what the WHO is saying, is that the artificial sweetened products shouldn't be used as part of weight loss programs anymore. So that was the key metric.
Mm.
We now are beginning to understand that these artificial sweeteners are also associated with upsetting the balance of good versus bad bugs we have in our colons, and may be associated with the probability of being heavier and gaining more visceral fat around your belly as time goes on.
Yes.
So we don't demonize food, particularly in the setting of diabetes. All food is good. You know, if you say Coke is bad, well, how come I'm having it when I'm having a low? You know, it can't be so bad then. So we're not here to demonize the product in that sense, but to advocate that water remains the most appropriate refreshment for young people.
Yeah.
The sugar-sweetened beverages, particularly the squashes that can be used, are probably the most appropriate if you were going to add on those sugar-free Likol-type products in that sense. And remembering that none of these products have any nutritional value at all. So they're there as a nice-to-have and certainly shouldn't be considered as part of the everyday. So from my side, they certainly get the thumbs down. And as time goes on, less and less good is coming out of their consumption.
I'd agree. And an additional thing is a lot of the squashes you did talk about, I think try and look for ones that are not full of lots of E numbers for artificial colorings, because they have possibly been indicated in ADHD and such disorders.
Thank you very much. Next up, we've got Jordan on the line.
Hi, Lorena. My name is Jordan Dreher. And I live with type 1. And my question is, how do you navigate telling people at work that you have type 1? Thanks for the show.
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I think a lot of people do have that inherent fear of making yourself seem less than worthy for the environment in which you work or play or live in. That's why the little segment we chatted about Warren Driscoll and Queen, It's a Kind of Magic, was actually for me so important. Because it demonstrates that there is actually no need to feel less than. In fact, just about every person with diabetes that we've had on the show to date has been exceptional in some way. So that's one thing, is first to have that inherent confidence in your own abilities that is apart from diabetes. That's where I would start. Stan?
I think it's always going to be challenging because you're giving a part of yourself away that wouldn't ordinarily be made mention. So unless the work scenarios are of a nature that you're having to declare this, there isn't a particular need. Unless you feel that your performance has been questioned, comes back to that original component, does my diabetes impact on my work performance? So it's a tricky one to mention. You can share it, but it must be understood that it's shared in the exact same confidence that it would be. I think by Warren wearing his continuous glucose monitor in his arms, really a badge showing the world that, listen, I have diabetes. Let's move on in that sense. And it's very nice to know that less and less there are stigma.
Mm.
But I will say this, Michael, and this happens every week. And I have a laugh with the person who tells me, Lorena, you have type 1 diabetes. Maybe this happened to you. This person opens up in the workplace. And the first thing that I'm told is that, really, you have diabetes, but you're not fat. Or what is type 1 diabetes? You know, my uncle had type 2. I've never heard of type 1. And time and again, the person with type 1 diabetes has kind of said, well, what's my body size got to do with the diabetes? People genuinely, I believe, the community at large, do not know enough about diabetes, and more specifically, have never heard of this orphan condition called type 1 diabetes.
Exactly.
That's true. We try so hard to normalize the word diabetes and to make it more acceptable in the community that's not known with it. But the moment you open your mouth, you immediately feel labeled because of what they know about diabetes. So it's not about what you know, it's what they know. And that is how they indoctrinate how you feel about talking about it.
I'd like to end off this answer encouraging people to share, because I think that has been a message that has come out quite strongly in podcasts to date, is that when you do share about it, and you obviously would need to be confident to do that, you're then given an opportunity to correct some of the myths and misconceptions that people might have about, you know, living with diabetes. The final point I wanted to make is that without disclosure, should you develop a hypoglycemic event and you're stumbling around looking drunk, that could end badly for you. It could make your introduction to a person with diabetes not turn out the best way it could have. So possibly while you're in your best state, when you're fully in charge of your faculties, talk about your condition, what it means, what I might need support for, and then work hard within your environment to make yourself as useful as you can be. Take up the role for which you are there.
Ultimately, A for advocacy. That's the message coming strongly through. And again, we're pleased to share a message of advocacy with our listeners this week, as we typically do, in support of SA Diabetes Advocacy. And again, the message this week implores all of us, our listeners, whether you're in healthcare, whether you're a person with diabetes, looking after somebody with diabetes too, add your support to an insulin advocacy petition signed by our local Society of Endocrinology, Metabolism and Diabetes, an important aspect for good diabetes care nationwide.
A recent contract circular in state healthcare, which details insulin options for people with diabetes, has reverted to vials and syringes instead of insulin pens, which were previously being provided. Insulin vials and syringes are outdated and difficult to use. They contribute negatively both to quality of life for people with diabetes and poor continued medication adherence, which leads to expensive long-term diabetes complications. At SA Diabetes Advocacy, we fully support this appeal by the Society of Endocrinology, Metabolism and Diabetes of South Africa, SEMSTA, and we'd love for you to sign the SEMSTA Insulin Petition. Please visit www.diabetesadvocacy.org.za, click on Campaigns, and click on Sign the Insulin Petition.
Thank you, Kirsten, for that important reminder. If you haven't signed that petition yet, please do it.
Next up, we've got Naeem.
Hi, my name is Naeem Sonpra, and I'm a person living with type 1 diabetes for 33 years now. I have a little bit of a dilemma with my insulin that has made me think about insulin resistance and sensitivity. It happens quite often where no matter how much insulin I take, my glucose levels will stay high. I try drinking more water, eating less carbs, and massaging my injection sites. Sometimes one of these methods will work, but other times I just have to wait it out. I'd like to know if there's any other tips or tricks that I could try when this happens. Thank you.
For me, Lorena, this is very common. You can see it in younger people such as this fellow or in people who are perhaps over the age of 50. And I like to take a very structured approach to this. Either the person who's mentioning this is going to be well or they're unwell. And in the presence of poor health, such as a bronchitis or a pneumonia, or you're recovering from a dog bite, you will develop a degree of insulin resistance. You may have recognized that. Insulin doesn't seem to work. You treat the illness and suddenly the blood glucose levels are more manageable. Let's assume that this is not the case and he describes himself as being well. Systematically, you want to go through a number of questions in your mind's eye, starting with, is your insulin okay? Are you rotating your needles? Are you injecting in the right spaces? Has somebody inspected your injection sites? Because how often we see in clinical practice that those simple technical logistic aspects of diabetes management contribute enormously. And somebody says, ah, we were in the Kruger Park and the insulin got cooked. I'm fine, doc. We had a case this past week in the clinic of a lady who underwent a neurosurgical procedure for a small brain tumor. She's done very well. Unfortunately, those at home didn't do so well in terms of curating her insulin form. And when she eventually got back from hospital, the stuff was cooked and she spent most of the Easter weekend on the phone with our hotline. So I like to think of those logistic aspects first. Michael, what do you think of when you hear a story like this?
Absolutely. I think that's where you started is the first thing. I remember our founder, Larry DeSilla, always used to say that insulin worked 100% of the time that you inject it or that you inject insulin that works. So taking into account technique, actually getting it under the skin or if the insulin is damaged. Then, of course, there are other technical issues like maybe not washing your hands before pricking your finger. Maybe Naeem works in a place where he's constantly dealing with sugary foods on his fingers, and maybe his hands aren't being cleaned properly. Less of an issue nowadays. I think it's probably very rare or it cannot happen at all. But in the old days, we used to have meters where you'd have strips that were coded to a particular batch. And if that wasn't done properly, you could get errant readings. I would like to bring Naeem in to his doctor's practice to actually let them inject him and see what happens. Because there was a well-documented case in America where a person was put on insulin and for 3 years their blood glucose did not come down. And eventually the endocrinologist referred the person to a diabetes specialist nurse. In 5 minutes, she found out that he was dialing the insulin dose onto the pen and then putting the needle into the skin and then dialing it back. He thought for 3 years he'd been injecting the insulin. And when he found out that no, he wasn't, he was just dialing back the dose, he thought, I always wondered why I was throwing away full pens of insulin. So that's another issue that needs to be sorted out technically. Then, Stan, I'm going to bat back to you because there are some syndromes of insulin resistance.
Sure. I want to examine this fellow. I want to be sure that there are no other medical matters.
Yes.
Underactive thyroid is not uncommon in people with diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other hormone matters. For example, low levels of testosterone can also show up in men as developing insulin resistance. I want to know about his body's production of cortisol. So a thorough physical examination will guide me over and above additional blood work.
Absolutely.
That may guide me as to why he's manifested this. But there is something that we are beginning to see more and more, and it speaks nothing to Naeem's personal case because we don't know anything about his body size, but we know that on average the world is getting heavier, and it's plausible that as he is getting older, he is laying down visceral fat around his belly, which renders him almost like a person with type 2 diabetes. So he not only has the deficiency of insulin for which he's having to take insulin for his type 1 diabetes, but he also has that inherent insulin resistance as part of type 2 diabetes, something that we call double diabetes. And in those cases, and assuming there are no medical matters and no technical aspects that we can understand here, he may be a candidate for non-insulin treatments, or adjunctive treatment as we call it, to help him. And in these cases, we might use glucophage or metformin. We might use treatments like that to help lower blood glucose without increasing the insulin dose. So my message here is that it isn't something that can just simply be understood if it isn't a technical issue. That can be solved very quickly. But he certainly needs to be examined, and it cannot be dismissed, because changing doses of insulin and getting less bang for your buck, that's telling us something is underfoot.
Again, all that we've said highlights the inherent complexity of managing diabetes. And it's not just a case of 1 + 2 = 3 in diabetes. You know, high blood glucose, add insulin, you get healthy levels of blood glucose. Doesn't always work like that. There are so many potential factors that can get in the way. And this is where you need to see someone who has extensive experience in the field, and they will be cognizant of all of the factors that we have raised, and possibly more.
Lovely. Thanks for the thorough answer. There's a lot of different directions to look at it. So I love that. Thank you so much. Our next question comes from Izona Lees.
Hi, my name is Izona Lees, and I've been a type 1 diabetic for quite a few years now. My brother was also very recently diagnosed with type 1, and we are the only ones in our family with this condition. We have no family history of diabetes, and this has been a crazy ride for the both of us. This had me wondering about something, and my question would be, can a traumatic life event or shock cause or instigate the onset of type 1 diabetes?
It's something common that we come across, where people verbalize that something traumatic happened to me and now I've got type 1 diabetes. So we know that any stressful event can change your immunity, and the type 1 diabetes is what we call an autoimmune condition that can result in autoimmune destruction of the beta cells that produce the insulin that regulates your blood glucose. However, what we know about type 1 diabetes is that although clinically it may appear as an event, the prodrome, or the time leading up to diagnosis, may in fact span a number of years. And so how I would probably answer this question is that you may have had this disease process leading to the expression of what we call type 1 diabetes in play for several years. And we know that there's a genetic predisposition, which then can be acted on by several life events, possibly things like lack of breastfeeding, possibly a too clean environment when you're young, possibly vitamin D deficiency, possibly infections like cytomegalovirus or flu virus or whatever, and possibly stressful life events, which might have actually tipped her over that diagnostic threshold and she develops overt type 1 diabetes. Why I want to make this clear is that if this is how the person thinks, there's a risk of that person then trying to avoid all life events that are stressful. And so we try and counsel people that, yes, it might have been the tipping point, but life is characterized by stress and we then need to help you manage it. But it wasn't necessarily the cause, but it may have been the trigger to the final expression of this condition. Stan, am I talking rubbish or do you agree?
Spot on. We see something near identical in people who develop Graves' disease.
Mm.
Graves' disease is an autoimmune overactive thyroid condition, and almost always when you read, particularly the older literature, there was almost always a stressful event that had triggered the underlying predisposition. So these young kids are born with a DNA abnormality that can actually be measured today, and those are the groups of patients in the US who were given that very expensive antibody drug to delay the onset of their diabetes, Michael, and put it into remission. We spoke about that previously.
Yes.
But there's always a second event. And one of the difficulties you see in clinical practice is that it's often hard to give closure to the condition. I think a lot of people with type 2 diabetes come in and they say, yeah, doc, you know, this was always coming. I haven't looked after myself well for a long period of time, and I'm not surprised I've developed diabetes. I was warned 20 years ago, and here I am, doc. What do we need to do? I find often people express frustration about type 1 diabetes, that there isn't that closure. You know, what could we have done differently, even if we had known? And it's sad to say, well, you know, you could have avoided cow's milk. Well, we didn't drink cow's milk before the age of one. Well, you should have had all the vaccines. We did all of that. And it sometimes feels sad for that component, that it would have been nice to have had that closure to say,
yeah,
Mr. Brown, we warned you, never get in a car accident, because if you do, you're going to get diabetes someday. And lo and behold, he has a small bumper bashing and there's the diabetes. So it is frustrating. The treatment of diabetes, the management of diabetes, the monitoring of glucose, the delivery of insulin leaps and bounds. But have we made great inroads into the understanding of the biology? We're not anywhere close to where we ought to be by this point in time. So I still say push for cure.
I hear of many kids who get diagnosed with type 1 on their birthdays or during the week of birthdays. Would you like to maybe add anything on that?
Well, Lorena, we know that globally, both in the Southern Hemisphere at the start of spring and in the Northern Hemisphere at the start of their spring, when all of the antigens, those are the things that our environment sends towards us, like dust and pollen and bed bugs and mites and all of those things, are in much greater volume than they are during the colder winter months. And there is always going to be a springtime surge in the new onset of diagnosis of diabetes. Yes, you may know people within a community who in with it, but it doesn't generally follow the geographic pattern that there is an inherent risk around the time of your birthday, unless it coincides with the seasonal variation. That's my take on it.
Yeah, maybe one possible thing is that indulging in a lot of birthday treats might, as I said, remember, type 1 diabetes development is a process, and it might just push you above that diagnostic horizon, get blood glucose high enough to produce some symptoms, and there you are, but not generally associated with birthdays per se.
Thanks for answering that. We have a question from Mark. He lives with type 2 diabetes, and he wrote, I have neuropathy and my feet burn and tingle and it's achy. Why is it more active at night? And when I lay down, it feels more active. How can I relieve the discomfort?
Right. So again, a very common condition in the context of diabetes. But as we've discussed before in previous episodes, whenever we suspect any condition involving the nerves and diabetes, the diagnosis must always be made by exclusion. So it means we have to exclude any other thing that could be causing those symptoms, vitamin B12 deficiency, any sort of spinal issue that could be impinging on the nerves to the feet and so on. Once we've satisfied ourselves that there is no other cause, then we can ascribe it to diabetes-related neuropathy. Now, a feature of diabetes-related peripheral neuropathy, what we call sensory motor neuropathy, is that it typically is worse at night. So that's one clue that could help us to say that that is so. And as Stan has indicated on a previous episode, it's possibly due to the fact that, you know, you lying there in bed, the normal stimuli of the day, the noise, the touch stimuli on your body, generally help those symptoms to recede into the background. But if you're lying there at night, you start feeling that burning, and then you get a sort of pain cycle where you experience pain, you start to get agitated, your perception of the pain goes up, and then it becomes a vicious cycle of pain. In terms of how we treat it, I'm going to leave that to Stan, but I want to say something first. The best way to treat diabetes-related neuropathy is not to get it. Now, no judgment there at all. Firstly, just to make sure that from diagnosis, we do everything we can to make sure that we spend as much time with our blood glucose in the healthy range, the so-called time in range that we've come to know with continuous glucose monitoring. Having said that, Stan, come in with some treatment issues, and it's a bit of a murky water, so that's why I'm handing it over to you.
So I like to think of it as a triangle because it's very rare to see pain occur on its own. It's often associated with poor or interrupted sleep. Mm-hmm. And in many people we see with painful peripheral neuropathy, often their moods are flat. They may have low-grade depression. That may be amplified because of pain, and pain amplifies it. So this triangle moves in all directions simultaneously. So it's important to recognize that painful peripheral neuropathy, and I'm using cheeky words here, is a nice condition to treat. If you don't treat it, you're just not affording yourself the opportunity to have less pain. But on its own, you're only treating the symptom of the condition. We do not have efficient therapies to reverse and restore the nerve function. Mm. We're getting very good and clever at doing that in the eyes, and we're getting very good these days and excellent results with kidney conditions complicating diabetes. Right. But with peripheral neuropathy, all of the treatments that we speak to are purely symptomatic. So if the person says to me, "Doc, but I'm fine. I can live with the pain. It isn't interrupting my days. It isn't interrupting my nights." Well, then there's no particular reason to go and rush them onto therapy for the sake of their pain. But it's their decision because it's a purely subjective appraisal as to their level of discomfort. There are a wide number of medications we use on prescription, and we also use a lot of vitamin B6 in this country, as well as alpha-lipoic acid, over-the-counter products that can also blunt some of these symptoms for peripheral neuropathy. Bear in mind, listeners, treatment for peripheral neuropathy is ongoing. So as long as you are getting relief with your particular prescriptive or non-prescriptive treatment, it is important to recognize that it becomes part and parcel of the chronic fabric. Make sure that your sleep is being attended to. You may need a particular therapy for that. And if your mood is flat for any reason or solely because of the peripheral neuropathy, that too needs an intervention. We've spoken about the positive impact of structured physical activity. I'd caution at this point that you can't just use physical activity to run outside and say, "Hey, Michael and Stan said that being physically active is as good for treating depression as a pill." Yeah, it may well be, if not better. But if you have peripheral neuropathy, you need to be careful when you undertake your structured physical activity. You don't want to undergo an injury that you may not feel, or even a fracture. You don't want to miss an ulcer and do something inappropriate. So, yep, plenty of room for exercise, but those feet need to be examined.
Yes.
You need to be seen and then being given the green light to go outside and exercise.
If I may just add one thing, there's something that happens very suddenly in diabetes-related neuropathy, and that's called insulin neuritis. And it's basically where, and I'm speaking particularly here to practitioners working in the field of diabetes, do not drop high blood glucose quickly, because that can create fluid shifts within the nerves and result in an intense peripheral neuropathy that happens suddenly, and it's almost intractable. And I've seen it lasting for many months, if not up to a year. So there's no particular hurry to achieve healthy blood glucose levels. Rather, do it slowly. There are many clinical reasons why we don't want to drop blood glucose precipitously. We want to get there. We want to get down to safe, near normal levels, but don't do it quickly.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
And thanks, Mark, for that question.
Great. I would like to know, are there any side effects of using medication for neuropathy? We had a discussion about a week back, and somebody told me they would rather live with a neuropathy than use more medication because they don't want any more ripple effect coming out of that.
So go back to what I said initially. If you have high blood pressure, it's something that has to be treated. The risks of leaving blood pressure untreated are massive. You could have a stroke, you could have a heart attack, and you can die. Treating peripheral neuropathy is a nice condition to treat because you can reduce your pain. But that needs to be looked at in the context of whether the medication you're going to be using is better for reducing the pain versus any potential side effects. So in this country, there are popular used medications like pregabalin, known by its original version as Lyrica. And for some uses, it may cause drowsiness. May cause mogginess. It can cause ankle swelling. It can, in some users, also cause weight gain. So it's a toss-up between the relief and improvement in the discomfort you are experiencing and the conversation you are having with your healthcare provider as to possible side effects. I often use a silly analogy, and I say, this isn't chemotherapy. This isn't treatment that we have to use. Give us 6 months, we'll get to the end of the course, and we'll go through it. This is something that we can use. And if it's not agreeing with you, we'll find a different dose. We'll find a different product to find out what works subjectively for you, because we have no other means of knowing the impact of the treatment for the better unless the person is telling us their pain is either unchanged or getting better.
Love that. Thank you.
Maybe just another note there on the use of opiates, common pain tablets that contain codeine. These are not indicated in the treatment of peripheral neuropathy related to diabetes. And in fact, the side effect profile being constipation and drowsiness and so on well outweighs any potential pain benefits that accrue because they work on different nerve pathways than are affected by the diabetes-related neuropathy.
Great stuff. This one is a bit more serious. It can be a bit more controversial and triggering, but that's what we're here for. So I think we need to bring this up as well. It's an anonymous question, and it says, keeping in mind all the complications associated with diabetes, whether type 1 or type 2, would you say diabetes is a degenerative disease?
So let's start with language matters. I want to remind our audience from last year that SweetLife put out a very important policy document that we've encouraged everyone to take note of. And again, there's no judgment for anonymous here. I'm bringing this up more for our healthcare professional listeners. So I just want to address two components of that question. Firstly, I would not talk about diabetes as a disease. It's a health condition. Like I have asthma, I'm still a very competitive runner, and my asthma has zero impact on that. Yes, diabetes has a far greater life influence than my asthma does, but the principle remains the same. Lorena, looking at you, you don't look diseased to me. That's the point I want to make. You look gorgeous. So
I'm having a great day.
Yeah. So I think let's rather avoid terms like diseased. Mm-hmm. The other important point, and we've made this before on the podcast, is that whenever we talk about complications that could accrue to having diabetes, we always should preface it with potential.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? It means that we have the ability to, in the old days, we would say prevent. And that can be seen as quite a pejorative term. So nowadays we talk about we now have the ability to reduce the risk greatly of any future potential complications. My short answer now to that longer introduction is that certainly I would not necessarily regard diabetes as a degenerative condition by itself. If we don't look after it from diagnosis and we don't look after it well, yes, you can develop potential complications. The other thing with type 2 diabetes, it is understood to be a generally progressive condition. Does that mean it's degenerative? No. What that progressive term means is that over time, there's a progressive decline in the amount of insulin that you are able to produce. That's how we've historically seen type 2 diabetes. Nowadays, with the very low calorie dietary approaches we've been talking about, there is a possibility of halting that process or slowing it greatly through the loss of excess tummy fat, fat that's contained within and around the organs of our abdomen. So that's my response. Stan, anything to add there?
I agree with that. When one thinks about degenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and osteoporosis,
yes,
great strides are being made there. There are now registered treatments for osteoporosis to literally reverse the degeneration of bone and build bone.
Mm.
And just more recently, treatments for Alzheimer's disease, the disease itself, not just the memory matters. So by definition, the disease entity within the pancreas may be presumed to be degenerative, but the person who has the condition is not going to degenerate if their condition is well managed. And I say this day in and day out to people who come to our clinic. If it were inevitable that the harms were going to accrue from diabetes, we wouldn't be talking about this because there was nothing we could do. And unfortunately, that reputation stalks us from our grandparents' generations, the 1940s and 50s.
Right.
It needn't be the mandate that we're managing diabetes here today. Great strides are being made. Great healthy lives. We've interviewed people of 50, 60, 65 years of their type 1 diabetes. They're not degenerating in that sense. Mm. So I think a great question. And Michael, a superb answer on your side there.
Thank you. Yeah, another passing thought is it's not a palliative condition to treat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you start off without any complications at diagnosis and you can maintain that health, you are likely, as we discussed last week, to be able to live a long, healthy, and productive life.
As always, the nature of the questions and the volume of the questions, and we've probably only just touched the tip of the iceberg here, Lorena, goes on to say that there is never an end to the learning in diabetes. And whether it be in a podcast such as this, in the doctor's office, in the diabetes nurse specialist, across the counter with the pharmacist, everybody is asking questions about diabetes because nobody has all the answers. Nobody can be given all of the answers all of the time, whether it be at diagnosis, a change of treatment, even at the end of life, when we make particular changes to the treatment of diabetes. So I think the learning here for me is actually the learning, and we must recognize that this condition is going to keep all of us on our toes make sure that we're the best advocates we can be for this condition. And Lorena, it's wonderful having you on the show. As always, you bring such great energy and vigor.
Wonderful.
And a superb community that you're sharing with us, who are then able to have their concerns and questions answered. Listeners, for those of you who want to extend the Q&A session, don't hesitate to drop us a line at podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. I'm going to say goodbye now, and I'll let Michael take us through to the end of the show.
Thank you, Stan. Lorena, it has been an absolute privilege and pleasure to have you on our podcast again. We love your bubbly personality, and we are so happy to give your advocacy efforts a platform. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks, Stan, for adding a personal touch to all the questions. Much appreciated.
So listeners, thank you so much for participating in this episode, and we look forward to another one in probably about another 6 to 8 weeks' time. Get those questions in to Lorena, and we'll put her email in the show notes. And having said that, thanks for joining us on our 50th episode. We'll be back with you next week, and that's over and out from us. Here's a reminder that this episode was brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and the new range of CDE MyWell reduced calorie products. Registered dietitians are the most appropriate healthcare professionals to facilitate real lifestyle changes around nutrition. To learn more about a VLCD program, check out www.cdediabetes.co.za/VLCD-practitioners for a VLCD trained dietitian in your area, or email providers at cdediabetes.co.za. If you are a registered dietitian and wish to become trained in the facilitation of VLCD dietary approaches, please consider the CD Academy Very Low Calorie Diet course for health professionals. Details in the show notes for this episode. Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.